The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at techserve.com.
We begin with a disturbing development in Iraq. Thursday, a prison raid led by Kurdish and American forces left an American commando dead, Master Sergeant Joshua Wheeler. He's the first U.S. citizen killed in action in Iraq since 2011.
At the request of the Kurdistan Regional Government, U.S. Special Operations Forces supported an Iraqi Peshmerga operation to rescue hostages at an ISIL prison near Hawija, Iraq. This operation was deliberately planned and launched after receiving information that the hostages faced imminent mass execution.
The prison had been claimed by the self-proclaimed Islamic State, and the rescue mission freed dozens of Kurdish hostages, a U.S. claimed success in the fight against ISIS in eastern Iraq. Joining us is Bayan Sami Abdulrahman, Kurdistan Regional Government Representative to the United States. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It seems to me this raid is a sign, one more sign, I would say, that Iraq is essentially partitioned and that the U.S. and the Kurdistan Regional Government are just working together in northern Iraq against ISIS, and the rest of Iraq is sort of a sideshow.
Well, partition of Iraq is a different subject from what the United States is doing in Iraq. The United States is supporting all of Iraq's forces. They're supporting the attempt to retake Ramadi, which doesn't involve Kurdish forces. But in Kurdistan, we're very grateful to the United States for supporting us. And we're very grateful that special forces of the United States took part in this raid on this prison. 69 lives were saved. Tragically, Joshua Wheeler lost his life, and I would like to express my deepest and sincerest condolences to his family and his friends, because even though he was involved in an operation that saved so many lives, the fact that he passed away will have hurt them very much.
Well, we appreciate those condolences, that's for sure. But this cooperation between the U.S. and Kurdistan, I mean, if you go to Erbil, it's very peaceful in Erbil. There's a huge investment of American forces and commercial materiel in Erbil. The situation couldn't be more different in Baghdad. It seems as though, as time goes on, Kurdistan acquires a kind of autonomy that essentially creates it as a nation state in and of itself, and it's irrelevant to Iraq as time goes on.
It's a fact that the people of Kurdistan want an independent state. This has been our dream since the days of the creation of Iraq. Nobody asked us, do we want to be part of a country called Iraq? Frankly, we haven't seen that many good things out of being a part of this country. We have seen repeated acts of genocide. Under Saddam Hussein, we had the Anfal genocide campaign, use of chemical weapons. Under ISIS, the Yazidi Kurdish community has been going through a genocide, and women have been sexually enslaved and so on. So, yes, you're right. The people of Kurdistan want an independent state. Today, we are focused on defeating ISIS because ISIS presents an existential threat. That's the focus of our fight today. But ultimately, yes, we want independence and we will achieve it.
So essentially, this model of U.S. and Kurdish cooperation centered out of Erbil in the territory of Kurdistan is working towards that goal. By fighting ISIS, you're also working towards the goal of an autonomous Kurdish state, and whether the U.S. likes it or not, we're involved in that mission.
Well, every Kurd would be delighted if that actually was America's policy. But when we talked to the State Department, and even when President Barzani met President Obama in May, the United States has been consistently clear that it prefers Iraq to stay as one country, but the United States recognizes that a centralized Iraq is over, that there needs to be what, I'm borrowing the words of the State Department, there needs to be functioning federalism in Iraq. I don't think
Bayan, functioning federalism is essentially an acknowledgement that Baghdad is never going to run things in Iraq anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Baghdad doesn't run things in Iraq already. The Kurdistan region is pretty autonomous. The large swathes of the Sunni Arab area have been taken over by ISIS, and perhaps the rest of Iraq is run by Baghdad. That is the case. And it is time that the international community accepted the realities on the ground. The way I see the future of Iraq is either there will be an independent Kurdish state, or perhaps Iraq will continue to remain as one country, but with three very autonomous areas. But, John, I just want to be clear that I think the United States' support for what the Peshmerga are doing has nothing to do with helping Kurdistan become an independent state.
No,
at least that's not the message they tell us.
No, no, and the State Department would deny that vigorously. But as again, recognizing realities on the ground, it gets us closer to that independence than farther away from it, it would seem. Bayan, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Bayan Sami Abdulrahman is Kurdistan Regional Government Representative to the United States. The new regime in Canada wasted no time signaling to its neighbor to the south that there would be no more business as usual.
It's time for a change in this country, my friends, a real change.
The victory by Liberal leader Justin Trudeau over Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who has governed Canada for 9 years, was a political shocker. But the realities are sinking in, and one of the promises of Trudeau's campaign was a pledge to pull Canada out of the U.S.-led bombing campaign against ISIS in Syria and Iraq.
We will be moving forward with our campaign commitments in a responsible fashion. We want to ensure that the transition is done in an orderly fashion.
And that would include pulling Canada out of the U.S.-led bombing campaign. Joining me now is Colonel George Petrolikas, fellow with the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. He served as personal representative and then as strategic advisor to the Chief of Defense Staff. Colonel, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good day, John.
Colonel, are Canadians counting on this promise being delivered on?
Well, the promise was made over the course of several debates. There were five during the electoral campaign, and it was certainly a theme with Justin Trudeau during the campaign. So it would be rather difficult for him to back away from that promise. And certainly most Canadians were aware of his position when they voted for him.
Would you say that Canada believes that the ISIS threat is less significant than the U.S. believes?
No, I think we, none of us in the West at least, underestimate the threat of ISIS. I think his position to a degree reflects the same discourse that you've had in the United States as to the effectiveness of the air campaign. And it's rather difficult to support a campaign that doesn't have winning as part of its vernacular. And what was promised initially by President Obama of a year to a two-year-long campaign has now metastasized to a campaign that's, you know, General Dempsey was saying might last anywhere up to, you know, 8 to 15 years. And I think it's rather difficult for people to sign on to a commitment of that duration.
How does that square with the attacks that have taken place in Canada that have Islamist sources and the reports that there are Canadians who are fighting in ISIS right now?
Well, you know, just like the United States, there's two parts to that. First is the security back home and additional powers that we've given to domestic security agencies to be able to track down chatter and radicalization. And at the same time, keeping an eye on people that are traveling to the region and trying to curtail that that travel. With respect to taking on ISIS, you know, my personal opinion is that I think it has to be taken on. So I think to a degree it's the wrong decision by Mr. Trudeau, but it's an understandable decision.
But that still, how would you address the radicalization problem in Canada if there are individuals who are going to join ISIS and who could conceivably, with their Canadian passports, end up back in Ottawa and Montreal on what mission we can only imagine.
Right. It's the same issue that both of our countries face. We've certainly expanded domestic policing powers and intelligence collection powers for agencies back home, as well as anti-radicalization efforts. So the focus has been on keeping people from actually going there. With respect to those that are already there, we have been revocating citizenship so far of people that are away. And we've certainly had some success in stopping them. But again, I understand, just like your own citizens do, the quandary that we're both in terms of stopping radicalization, stopping the flow of foreign fighters, and also extinguishing the flame that attracts them.
Is there some concern? I mean, it was a real political shocker that Justin Trudeau won, right? I mean, no one was predicting that earlier this week.
Yeah, there was certainly a prediction towards a minority government of some sort. No one predicted the wave of support that he managed to gather in the last 48 hours. And the jury's a little out right now, whether it's directly support for him in change or to a degree a fatigue with the previous government. So we'll see where it goes.
Well, that motivates my last question, which would be, if it is just fatigue with Stephen Harper and the 9 years that have just passed, are Canadians scratching their heads and going, is Justin Trudeau ready for this new responsibility here, including the kinds of things we've just been talking about?
Well, I think they're ready to give him the benefit of the doubt, and certainly in certain international issues, for example, like climate change, they seem to be supportive of the positions that he's going to take at the upcoming COP21 conference in Paris. But we'll certainly get a feel for where he stands on a number of issues. As you know, there are four major international conferences coming up in the next 6 weeks. So we'll probably all get a much better measure of what his foreign policy initiatives look like.
Colonel George Petrolikas is a fellow with the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. He served as personal representative and then as strategic advisor to the Chief of Defense Staff. Colonel, thanks so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like genetics, graphic design, and golf. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
The new film Rock the Casbah is something like Crazy Heart meets Mad Max, a comedy about the music business in Afghanistan, with guns and guitars and girls daring to lose the veil and take a chance on becoming pop stars on the Afghan version of American Idol. The story centers on a has-been rock manager on a USO tour of Afghanistan for some quick cash, played by Bill Murray. The manager, Ricky Lands, stumbles over one fiasco after another until at the moment of his greatest desperation, Richie discovers a young Afghan girl named Salima with an amazing voice, played by Palestinian actress Leem Lubani. Is that really you?
Yes.
Wow, that's great.
Aw, thank you.
Oh, I mean, you really did have a feeling in the film that you're coming upon somebody who's a real talent.
Thank you.
This is such a remarkable story. It's a great cast. What was your first impression of this project?
I read it and I fell in love with Salima, the character. I felt that she's such a courageous young girl that has a dream. And her dream is, you know, not to be famous, or she's not looking for fame or for wealth. She basically wants to let her voice out.
You know, Bill Murray is one of the most experienced comedic actors on planet Earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's and you play a comedy team in this film.
Yep.
He's the what? You're the what? How would you describe it?
Well, Bill Murray, he's a hilarious human being, to be honest. I mean, what you see on set is basically what you see off set. But I think what's wonderful is the scenes between me and Bill, they're full of emotion. You know, Salima's not a comedian part in the film. She's basically where she brings, you know, Richie Lanz, that emotional side of his. So I think that's something that I really loved about them both, about their relationship, what she brings out of him.
I must go to Kabul. Allah gave me this voice. This is his gift.
Absolutely. But why are you in my trunk?
I must honor him with my music. I must celebrate my God with my singing. I must go to Kabul.
Hey, you're preaching to the choir, but, you know, your father, family, apparently, will kill me.
Then it is Allah's will and we shall die together.
No, no, we shall not. I have no intention of dying, ever.
You see in the film these American soldiers over in Afghanistan, and they're not having a very good time, and they don't seem to be succeeding at anything particularly, and they're trying to have influence, and the Afghans there are just like tolerating them if they're not blowing them up with IEDs. And yet, the American influence that comes through is you singing a Cat Stevens song.
Yeah. I think I'm bringing them both sides together in a way by art, nothing else. You know, no violence, no all that mess that's going up there. It just by singing, I bring two completely different thinking together by just, you know, letting my voice out. And I think that's beautiful.
Do you think it mattered to your character whether you won or lost in Afghanistan Idol?
No. I don't think so. No. I mean, for her, she won only by just singing. I mean, she knew deep down that a lot of people in Afghanistan liked that she was on stage and a girl singing. And she was an inspiration for a lot of young girls were, you know, sitting back there and crying a little bit. You can see in the movie. I think by only that, she won a lot for her. It doesn't matter if she won the Afghan Star. Just by standing there, she won.
Liam Lubani, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Liam Lubani stars opposite Bill Murray in Rock the Casbah. The film also stars Kate Hudson, Zooey Deschanel, and Bruce Willis.
We've been playing in these grungy mungholes waiting for our big break.
The numbers all go to 11.
I am a golden god!
Yeah! Cello.
Okay, this is a bass guitar, and it's the exact same thing, but instead of playing like this, you tip it on the side. Cello.
If it's movies, it must be Friday. And with me in the studio now, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, and Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. They're both the hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
So we've got a couple of A Star Is Born plot lines this week, I think it's fair to say. The first one is Jem and the Holograms. Let's hear a clip.
It just seems like ever since we got here that I've been leading this double life, you know, because Jem was supposed to be a disguise and something that I could hide behind. But now it just seems to be this other version of me, and I don't know, more and more it seems to be the only version that, you know, people want.
Big female cast here. What did you think, Kristen?
So that's Aubrey Peebles. She's playing Jerrica, a.k.a. Jem. She's a girl who just is living in the suburbs in California. Her sister uploads a video of her singing to the internet. Before you know it, she's an overnight singing sensation. She's got a record contract, but she's got this Jem identity on stage and this Jerrica identity off stage. She doesn't know how to make the two meet. Plus, she's got this robot, and this robot is always telling her hopeful things, but is making the world more mysterious than it needs to be. This is a far cry from the TV series, so anybody out there who was a fan of the TV series, as I was as a little kid, is probably not going to enjoy this. This is not feminist like the TV series. The TV series, Jem/Jerrica, was the head of her own record label. She was an executive. She knew how to use technology to her advantage. There's none of that in this movie. Instead, it's kind of just like a Hannah Montana rewrite, but just done with very bad camera work that looks like it's on a 12-year-old's YouTube channel.
Ooh, Raver.
Yeah, I would have to agree, except for the fact that I thought the cartoon show was horrible to begin with, and I think this film is also horrible. And here's my main problem with the film. What is this whole agonizing that Jem is doing between her false identity and her real identity? She's a pop star. We all know that pop stars walk this weird line between artifice and authenticity, and I think today's teenagers know that. I think we're well beyond the era where we thought, oh, you know, my wholesome pop star is, you know, I can't believe that he's actually a real person.
My four teenagers shapeshift all the time.
Exactly.
Believe me, they have no problem moving from personality to personality. The one they think is famous and the one that they just want to scream at me with. That's for sure. Movie number two is Rock the Casbah. This is a strange premise here. A Star is Born. I think I described it as Crazy Heart meets Mad Max. Let's hear a clip.
From the moment you heard me sing, since you found me in the cave, since we were put here on this earth, everything in our lives has led us to this time, this place. Richie Lenz, our story is already written, and now we shall play our parts.
Richie Lenz is Bill Murray. Rafer, what did you think about this film?
Well, you know, most of it takes place in Afghanistan. He's a rock manager. He's discovered this young singer out in Afghanistan, and he has an epiphany. I must bring this girl's beautiful voice to the world. But of course, meanwhile, there is an ongoing war happening, a real ongoing war in Afghanistan. I think that's the wrong backdrop for wacky slapstick comedy. I don't think IEDs are funny. I don't think village massacres are funny. And I feel like this film thinks it's all kind of hijinks. I think this film thinks that Afghanistan is the same thing that The Hangover thought Las Vegas was. It's all full of colorful characters like Bruce Willis and Danny McBride. I found that really offensive, not to mention that I think the film is just meandering, overstuffed, and not funny.
Any chance that the backdrop idea is actual commentary?
You know, I like where you're coming from, John, but I don't think they're succeeding at that. If that's what they're trying to do, they're not quite succeeding. I have to agree with Rafer on this. I think that it is overstuffed, and they didn't really know what to include, what not to include. You have the hooker with the heart of gold. You have the arms dealer who's really wacky.
Yes.
You have so many different characters in here. If they just concentrated on our singer with the voice of an angel and our shady manager and just their relationship and the juxtaposition between capitalism and what it is to be earnest, that would have worked so much better. And that would have been a better commentary on what's happening there.
Podcast this week?
We have our own reenactment written by the great Rafer Guzman of Jem.
Fantastic. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, John. You too.
We've been exploring the educational alternative represented by the more than 1,600 community colleges across the USA, serving more than 6 million students. Community colleges are good at seeing what their local communities need, but they may or may not be able to commit resources to meet those needs. Community colleges are less expensive than traditional four-year institutions, but many of you told us that while cost is a factor, the chances for success in college, you say, are based just as much on clarity and commitment going in, and that community college dropout rates remain high. Alex from Oregon writes on our site, "There's a bit more to the cost of college than just tuition, and that limits how many apply to Ivy League schools. Never mind the actual acceptance rates. Many people still need to do some careful planning, including weighing the varied graduation and career placement rates of lower-priced schools." Shanna Jaggers is assistant director of the Community College Research Center at Columbia University's Teachers College. She's also co-author of the book Redesigning America's Community Colleges, A Clearer Path to Student Success. Getting graduation rates up means convincing students that their completed degree programs have real value in the real economy.
Community colleges are designed to serve the whole community, which is a very diverse mix of people with different kinds of goals and who have different types of issues that they're dealing with in their life outside of school. But one of the problems that we have with community colleges right now is that they don't necessarily assess the goals that students have up front. So if a student leaves without graduating, we don't know if that's a success or a failure. So in the book, we propose that community colleges need to do a much better job of first helping students explore and identify their goals, and then help support students to meet those goals.
Liberal arts colleges love to talk about the well-roundedness of a liberal arts education and that it provides this magical, intangible something or other that gives people a sense of what civilization is about, the shared values of that civilization, et cetera. Is there an analog to that in community college? Is there something different but equally valuable that community colleges provide that constitutes the magic there?
Absolutely. So community colleges have sort of two different tracks. There's the transfer track, which is supposed to prepare you for going on to a four-year college, and then there's the more career technical occupation track that's supposed to allow you to go out into the workforce. And both of those do have a type of liberal arts component. We recommend that community colleges take much more seriously the concept of a liberal arts education. What is it that they want their students to be able to do by the time they leave the community college and transfer to a four-year college, and make sure that their curriculum is designed explicitly to help students do that? And similarly, in the career technical education track, students really need to have the kinds of soft skills that employers are looking for. Creative thinking and being able to work with other people and being able to learn things on your own. And so those components need to be integrated into career technical education through some of those liberal arts type courses, or at least sort of pieces of that curriculum that can be integrated into these more career oriented courses.
I consider, and this is deliberately a prejudice, a myth, I consider a run-of-the-mill community college to be a place where you learn computer science, nursing, physical therapy, maybe industrial auto mechanics, and that's about it. What's an innovative institution that's really worthy of exploration by your prize committee?
There are many different kinds of innovative, creative industries. A lot of community college programs have entrepreneurship programs that are designed to help students find their joy and passion and build a business around it. I was just in Virginia and heard the governor of Virginia speak, and he talked about the importance of green energy to the Virginia economy. They have one of the largest solar fields in the country that has just been installed. And he spoke to the community college presidents and said, you know, I went out to that solar field and I was so excited about all the new jobs it's going to bring to Virginia. And I looked at one of those solar panels and it said, made in Georgia. I don't want to see that anymore. From now on, I want to see made in Virginia. I want to see at least three or four community colleges that have a solar panel production that is filling our solar fields here in Virginia.
Did you begin with this faith in the community college system, or did you have to acquire it?
I didn't think a lot about community colleges before I started working at the Community College Research Center. I wasn't entirely aware of the sector because both of my parents have master's degrees. It was always assumed that I was going to go on and get at least a bachelor's, probably more. I would say that one of the first things that impressed me about community colleges was the passion that so many instructors and administrators have about the mission to help so many low-income students succeed and move forward to success in their life. Seeing that really inspired me to feel that, you know, these people care. They really want to know how they can change their practice in order to make the world better, and I can help them do that.
That's a really touching story because because you hear about people who go to the Kennedy School at Harvard who want to then leave the Kennedy School and, you know, go be at the UN or be a cabinet secretary or something like that and change the world that way. But it's so interesting and beautiful to hear the idea that, no, in fact, the social change, the changing of the world begins that first day of community college.
Oh, yeah. I think that's absolutely true for so many of these students. They're the first in their family to go to college. It feels like they're stepping into a whole new universe, that the world might be opening up for them and for them to, you know, maybe get halfway through a first semester and feel like they're floundering, to feel like they're failing and to withdraw is really, really heartbreaking. And the faculty who see this every semester, they want to know how they can stop that.
Is the redesign process you describe in your book an expensive one?
A lot of the things that we recommend in our book can be done with minimal cost by reallocating resources within the college. For example, buying out a faculty member's course for the semester. So instead of teaching the course, they are working on redesigning aspects of the curriculum. There are other things that cost a little bit more money. One of the key ones is new technology systems to support a lot of the change in processes that we're recommending. The technology is not there to replace anybody. It's there to help people do their jobs more efficiently and more effectively. But those systems are expensive. In general, we believe that the amount of extra money that you would spend on a student in any given semester will be amply repaid by the higher number of students who actually complete their program of study. So the taxpayer and student money that was spent on tuition is not being wasted by a student who doesn't get to their goal.
Shanna Jaggers, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
Shanna Jaggers is the Assistant Director of the Community College Research Center at Teachers College, Columbia University, and co-author of Redesigning America, Community Colleges, A Clearer Path to Student Success. Our Community College Challenge continues next month. We'll introduce you to the 5 community colleges we'll feature throughout the academic year, their students, and the innovative ways they're approaching higher education. And here's a little something to take with you today. Life on Earth did not begin 4.5 billion years ago. It may have begun 300 million years before that. Carbon-producing molecules left traces of graphite-like crystals that stayed intact for billions of years in ancient rock formations. The evidence, reported by scientists at UCLA, comes from the Jack Hills in Australia. 4.5 billion, 5 billion, and no evidence of a tree of knowledge anywhere. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. When did life begin in your life? Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And you can ask me anything on Twitter every day. I take your questions, sometimes your complaints, and do my best to get back to you personally. Tweet me your questions at Jay Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.